Bauer number two. We are in the midst of a rollicking contest between the Heat and Celtics. That game is close in the final minute. We'll talk to Carson Brebber later in the hour about this game and the game to come, Game 7 between the Clippers and Nuggets. But the big story today that was breaking pretty much as we got on air, despite suspicions burbling up in the Twitter sphere, among other places, all throughout the day, the Big Ten looks like they are finalizing plans to go ahead with an 8-game college football schedule, overturning their previous ruling in which they decided that fall sports of any kind would not be played in 2020 amidst concerns for long-term health of athletes dealing with COVID-19. It appears that the schedule is being aimed to start in the neighborhood of October 17th to October 24th. They will play 8 games, culminating in a conference title game around the weekend of December 19th, the day before the college football selection show. This is really bad. This is stupid. Does anybody in this room disagree with me?
I mean, I don't think it's great. It's not ideal. 8 games isn't really enough, to be completely honest, for if they have a team such as an Ohio State that's really seriously looking to make the college football playoff, which to me would be the one main goal of even playing this at all at this point after they kind of hurried up and canceled it. And then everybody else started playing, and they looked kind of stupid. And then they were like, ah, maybe we should play since the NFL is playing and, you know, 8 other or however many other college conferences we have playing, 7 or 8, something like that.
Fun Belt, baby.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. The Sun Belt and Army and, you know, Louisiana Lafayette's going up to Iowa State and whipping up on Brock Purdy and the boys up there in Ames. So why can't the Big Ten play football is basically what this has become. And so now they're trying to figure out a way that they can play football, but it's not great.
Adorned in my ASU colors, which I mention every episode at least once, that I attend Arizona State in my free time. The Pac-12 will follow. They are a follower conference led by an incompetent individual in Larry Scott. They will do whatever the Big Ten decides to do. So expect them to play as well. That will factor in.
How does the Pac-12 even put together a plan to play football at this point?
It's literally, they do the exact same thing the Big Ten does, except with their teams.
That was so many P's in my last statement. I just noticed that. Anyway. Like, if, okay, let's say, best case scenario, Big Ten announces tonight. That means by next week, the Pac-12 probably has to, if they want to play football, have a working plan of how they want to move forward with this season, having to start at probably around the same time that the Big Ten would be. That October, the third or fourth week of October is pretty much if you're and would the Pac-12 play 8 games? They're going to play 9 games?
Yeah.
10 games?
They'll play 8 games. Most likely, I would surmise that it would be the other teams from the South or the North, depending on the division. That's a natural thing. And then they'd play 3 other conference opponents from the other side.
But what Big Ten or Pac-12 team, Pac-12 more specifically, Big Ten kind of besides Ohio State, is making the college football playoff, even if they go undefeated in 8 games, over a 9-1. Let's say, okay, Alabama runs through undefeated in the SEC, 10-0. Then you have a Georgia or whoever else coming in it, or a Florida, maybe Tennessee, hopefully.
Hey, no.
Probably not. At a 9-1 or 8-2. Realistically, the college football playoff committee is not putting in,
I don't know if that's true,
an 8-0 Oregon over a 9-1 Georgia.
See, I don't know if that's true. I think that you're probably right. This is a weird year because, for a lot of reasons, we aren't going to have this cross-conference pollination where we get a gauge for where the conferences stand in comparison to one another.
Which hurts the Pac-12 because they, absolutely, out of the Power 5 conferences,
absolutely,
they're probably the fifth one.
They will not send a team to the playoff. I think that is highly unlikely unless we get just a bunch of teams beating each other and a lot of two-loss teams from the ACC, the SEC, and the Big 12.
I mean, honestly, realistically, these are the bottom two Power 5 conferences.
I don't know if the Big Ten is bottom two. I'd say they are firmly ahead of the ACC, maybe ahead of the Big 12 as a number two conference. just based on the teams they've been able to put into the playoff.
Well, take away Ohio State.
Well, Ohio State is a conference.
Exactly. That's my point.
But they also make it to playoff. I guess the whole hard part of this is exactly what you said. If Ohio State goes 8-1, and Auburn goes 8-2, 9-2, it gets difficult. It gets really hard to decide who should and shouldn't make the playoff, especially in a year where you can't say, okay, well, your prize for playing is you get to go play in the Cotton Bowl. Because I don't anticipate there will be other bowl games.
I mean, yeah, you might have, what, New Year's Six?
That's an optimistic outlook.
Unless you get, you know, a cure out of nowhere.
Some people will try. Like these preseason college basketball tournaments, the Battle for Atlantis happening in Sioux Falls, but they have to keep the name for proprietary reasons and different contracts that they signed. So the Battle for Atlantis will be in Dakota this year.
Battle of the Black Hills.
Indeed. But it's still the Battle for Atlantis. The Maui Invitational may well be in a gym in Charleston, South Carolina.
That's honestly a genius name. If that's still sponsored by Bad Boy Mowers, there's no reason that they should not change the name. Battle for the Black Hills.
That's a lot of bees. Bad Boy Mowers.
Sponsored by Bad Boy Mowers.
I love it.
The alliteration there is mint.
Trademark. But you'll probably get some spin-off bowl games where two teams come to agree to play somewhere where they can quarantine. That's pretty reasonable. But in a season where the big games, those consolation prizes, won't be on the table, and you're telling a one-loss Notre Dame team that only lost to Clemson that they can't go, and I guess that's impossible because they'd have to see them in the conference championship game. So let's play that game. What if Clemson beats Notre Dame in the regular season, but Notre Dame beats them in the conference title?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, the probability of there being two ACC or SEC teams, I'd put that way more likely than there being maybe one Big Ten team, maybe Ohio State, but definitely both those are way more likely than having a Pac-12 team.
And I totally agree with that. ASU, honestly, was probably looking like the best team in the Pac-12 South. Oregon, despite some flaws, we were going to find out. They were going to play North Dakota State and Ohio State. That obviously didn't happen. But that was a team that had the best aspirations nationally coming into the year. They're not going to get that chance. Penei Sewell has already said he's not playing, as well as, I believe, two of the four guys in their secondary that are supposed to be NFL players. So anything out of the Pac-12 is probably not happening. The only person that's going to be, or the only team rather, that's going to be able to come in and say, hey, look at us. Penn State, Ohio State, and Michigan probably are the three that with their name brand and with their teams coming into the year being potentially as good as you would think they might be, they could say at 8-0, if they go 8-0, you can make an eye test argument. I firmly believe Ohio State's one of the best teams in the country. In my preseason poll, I had them number one. That is going to be an awesome team this year that really doesn't have any holes and maybe the best quarterback in the country, although I definitely think it's Trevor Lawrence.
It's fair.
All that said, they may be playing two less, potentially even three less games. If they don't end up having a conference championship, what happens? I don't know. And I'm speculating here and trying not to lean too far over my skis because I'm just reading up on the story. So, frankly, some of the answers to these questions I'm asking, I don't know. I've not looked at all the hypotheticals. I don't know things for facts. I may sound stupid. I may say something wrong, and that's just going to come from a place of ignorance right now. Justin, it looks like you have something to say.
Well, you don't know because the people that are in charge of this stuff don't even know.
And that's also fair.
But to me, there's the conference championship point. For any of these conferences, especially if you're looking at a season where you probably have no bowl games, realistically, the only thing that college football teams are playing for at this point is A, money. That's the big one.
Which is the only thing.
But then conference championship and the opportunity for a national title. So especially for the Pac-12 and Big Ten, where Big Ten, unless you're Ohio State at this point, you're kind of playing for peanuts. You're looking at the opportunity to win your division and hopefully go to a conference championship. Other than that, you're probably not going to have, like, probably not, well, maybe have a Rose Bowl. Maybe. But other than that,
God willing,
what else are you looking at?
Yeah, and that's the hard part in all of this is, like, how is this going to pan out? And I guess that's my biggest problem with what they did, because if you're going to have these reservations, which are reasonable, I led this program on our first day by saying, I am not going to blame anybody for the reaction or choices in response to COVID, because that is their own option. You are autonomous. That is the freedom that is afforded to you by being in this country. That is a fact. If long as you're not hurting other people that aren't making those choices, if you're making choices for other people, I take issue with that. But when it comes to these conferences, right, they made a decision based on information they had, which is inconclusive, because everything regarding COVID and its long-term effects is inconclusive right now. We're not going to know for a couple years. But you made decisions based on the medical information you had, maybe rationally, maybe not. I tend to lean to the side of that was the right choice, because you were doing it to protect your athletes, supposedly. Now you're feeling pressure from other conferences, and it's not even been 2 weeks. There's no way to know what the effect of COVID on these football-playing schools is going to be. Texas A&M has 77 positive cases in their program. We don't know how bad it's going to be for fans. We just don't know yet. We've made the decision that that's an acceptable risk, and I've been over that. I just don't understand how, without the amount of information you would need based on what these other conferences have done so far, watching them make mistakes and seeing what works and doesn't, why they would deem now is the acceptable time to go ahead.
Well, I mean, everything you're seeing here is an oopsie. You know,
yeah.
They canceled, Pac-12 canceled. We expected there to be a domino effect, and at least probably the Big 12 cancel. SEC and ACC have always kind of been like, whatever, we're playing. But, you know, if those three all canceled, you expected kind of everybody else to follow suit. Some of these guys have gone ahead and played, and it's working so far through, what, week one, really, in the Power 5 schedule. SEC hasn't even started yet, but they're seeing everyone else play. It's kind of working. So they're like, well, maybe we need to revisit this. But the problem is that now is probably too late to do anything of substance, honestly, for a 2020 football season.
And listen, the SEC hasn't started yet, and you're going to get to find out a better sample size with that. I personally have a problem with schools letting fans in. I think you're asking for it, but I understand the importance. From an economic standpoint, I understand the importance. And when I say this is all monetarily driven, that's because it is. I also don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. We live in a capitalistic society. It is important to make money. These athletic departments are doing this not just to line pockets, although that is a byproduct. They're doing it because they have to stay afloat. These economies, towns like Auburn, Alabama, Lincoln, Nebraska, in a degree. This community, they need college football, and I get that. I just think that with all of this, people aren't taking the necessary considerations. They're not thinking about long term. I'm not in the room. What do I know? These people are all smarter than I am, and I admit that as well.
I don't even know if they know.
But that's the thing. It just looks like, from the outside looking in, which is the only perspective that I am privy to, from the outside looking in, what the hell are you doing? Do you know? Because it doesn't look like it. We'll talk about the NBA on the other side of a break. This is Run It Up, WKGN, Fox Sports Knoxville. Justin got tired of playing the basketball song, he says, right before we go on air. But if we're talking about playoffs, we're probably talking with Carson Breber, and actually I know for a fact we are, because he's on the phone. Carson, how are you?
I'm doing well, and I just want to say that I respect Justin's artistic decision there, although I will, you know, and I already do miss the basketball song. You know, he's creative, and he's got to do what he's got to do.
It'll be back. Don't you worry. I'm sure you'll be back, Carson.
Yes, because
I hope so.
He's on the show every day. If you haven't figured out, it's kind of a part of the brand at this point. Because Carson Breber's smart, and it's an important time to actually know what you're talking about, because the margins are thin right now. That being exemplified by the fact that this game is somehow an overtime, I've not been able to fully pay attention. This is a dilemma that I run in with all sporting events into, is that they're on while I'm on air. So it's kind of hard for me to focus on two things at once. So give me the spark notes.
Well, it's honestly tough because so much has happened that I don't know how quickly I can summarize it for you. I think that really what it comes down to is if you thought going into this series that one team was going to dominate fourth quarters, I at least would have said with a good deal of confidence it would be the Boston Celtics, the team with the better shot makers, with Jason Tatum, with Kemba Walker, with Jaylen Brown. And it was the exact opposite today. The Heat kicked it up a notch really on both ends of the ball, and I think that we saw some real struggles from the Celtics' high-level shot makers in closing this game. Kemba is not creating separation with much success throughout this game. They've been throwing doubles at him a lot like what we saw the Raptors do, and he has been baffled by it. Not as much late in this game, so he's been getting some more one-on-one looks. But this Heat team, I think, really did make some serious improvements midseason on the defensive end, you know, with those acquisitions of Iggy and Jay Crowder, and I think that I probably underestimated those in the regular season. We saw them pay off in a big way against the Bucks, and we're seeing them pay off again in this series. And the fact that the outcome of this game is not clear, with really considering that the Celtics had it in the palm of their hands, to me is both an endorsement of the toughness of this Heat team, but also, I would say more significantly, definitely a concern and a bit of a red flag with the Celtics team, because this is the kind of game that they should have just locked up, especially when you get 26 points from Marcus Smart, and that has not been the case, obviously.
Marcus Smart has been so good this postseason, especially over the last two series. That has been crucial for this Boston Celtics team, but that was the question. The Celtics team is distinctly young, much younger and much less experienced than this Boston, or rather this Miami team, although these guys have been here before. They were in an Eastern Conference Finals only 2 years ago, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
So you would expect them to be in a position to know how to handle these late-game situations. They won seven games with LeBron James. But
yeah,
that doesn't seem to have been the case, as it looked like, out of the corner of my eye, the Heat were down 8, and then it was 6, and then it was 3, and all of a sudden they're in overtime.
It was 12 to start the fourth quarter, and I think that you put it perfectly. Jason Tatum, actually, I'm going to put it perfectly. Jason Tatum is playing like a 22-year-old. He is a 22-year-old. He's in his third NBA season, and that's fair, but when you have a guy who is still so contact-averse in the big spots, when he's not willing to go downhill, where he kind of just puts his back to someone smaller than him 20 feet from the bucket and clearly doesn't have a plan, that's not great late-game offense, which is why we've seen them turn to Kemba. Kemba's had a terrible game today, so they just haven't been able to get it going anywhere late. And, you know, it's been the veterans. It's been the guys that have the confidence. It's been Jimmy Butler. It's been Goran Dragic stepping up in these big spots and going out there and taking this game as much as the Celtics have given it away to them, which I think is also a big component.
Bam Adebayo also with another strong game. Good defense, 17 points, 9 boards. Game is still ongoing. There's 12 seconds left in the contest. I'm on stream, maybe a little bit behind, maybe talking out my butt here. With the game having already ended, Jimmy Butler's at the line. He just sunk a free throw to go up 2 with 12 seconds left in OT. Jay Crowder has given them 22 points on 5 of 9 from 3. Goran Dragic was masterful in the bits that I got to watch. Great touch from him, driving and attacking. Defensively, if you're Boston, you don't necessarily play a bad game, but I don't know. They've got Jason Tatum right now on Jimmy Butler. I don't know if that's the matchup you want going forward. How has that played out throughout this one?
Well, I think that actually it worked out pretty well for much of this game. Jimmy was having a pretty quiet performance until late, and he's asserted himself now and obviously just got that huge and one. I think that what's really stood out about this Heat team is, first of all, the continued excellence of Goran Dragic, who was their leading scorer in their first playoff series and was pivotal again in their second-round series, and then has been tremendous today. He takes just the ceiling of this team up another level because Jimmy's not going to get you 30 every game. And so when you have that other guy who can get you 20 consistently, who can create for himself at a high level, Dragic does that. And he's really valuable because of that. And you mentioned Crowder. I mean, he's just been phenomenal today. Obviously, he's not going to, you know, knock down every open shot every game, but he's been fantastic.
I just always think it's funny. These late game lineups for the Heat are so good. And I think offensively, you look at a guy like Tyler Hero, who just apparently doesn't care and is unfazed in these late-game situations. It's kind of like Duncan Robinson evolved into Super Saiyan mode, and now he's Tyler Hero just running around out here hitting these big clutch dog mode shots, and they just have so much dog, as, man, Bam Adebayo just had an incredible defensive play to deny Jason Tatum a dunk that would have tied the game. Which of these two teams has the higher defensive ceiling? Which of these two teams has more dog factor to them?
Well, I think that those are two different questions, because I think the higher defensive ceiling is with the Celtics. They were the best defense in the playoffs thus far, and I think that makes sense when you consider their personnel. They have so many versatile, high-level, all-defense-level wings there, and they have a brilliant coach. But the dog factor has to go to the Heat. I mean, even though the Celtics are incredibly tough in those big moments, they just went up against the Raptors, who I probably would have thought have the greatest dog factor of any team in the league, but the Heat are right there. And I think that they have shown that today, and the fact that Bam just stood there and didn't back down and also didn't foul, I think is, you know, telling in a demonstration of that.
And Jason Tatum has been so uneven in these playoffs. I didn't necessarily, upon initial appraisal of the series, think that he had to be the top 10 player that he can be, that we've talked about him as, for them to win. After watching this, I kind of do think that. Do you agree?
I don't. To me, this loss is on Kemba Walker. I mean, Kemba was terrible in this game. He repeatedly tried to force the issue. He repeatedly missed shots, and he is the reason that they weren't able to close, because this game shouldn't have been close to begin with. If Kemba had a good game, considering the performance they got from Marcus Smart and the fact that Tatum was having a really good game until he needed to close late and then he faded a little bit, the game would have been over. And I found some interesting statistics. I already tweeted these, but I'm going to repeat them here, because if you look throughout the Celtics' Big Three season, Kemba is far more prone to having really just off-scoring nights. 33% of his games, he scored 15 points or less. He has the same amount as Tatum and Jaylen combined. And I think that you look at the numbers, and when Kemba just has a solid outing, when he has over 15, they're 33-9. And so I looked at it coming into this series, and I thought, Tatum may have a couple games where he fades a little bit. That might be okay. The Celtics are probably a good enough team to overcome that. But what they need is solid Kemba Walker. They need Kemba to be that assertive scorer, the kind of guy who can take over a game late, and he was the polar opposite of that tonight. And I really think that a huge responsibility for this loss falls on him.
Well, and he's always been the cardiac Kemba. He made great plays down the stretch against Toronto in several games, one of which they lost on that OG Anunoby shot. That is something that is going to be a determining factor to what this team can do. Because, yes, Jaylen Brown is erratic. Or rather, Jason Tatum is erratic. Jaylen Brown has been terrific. So has Marcus Smart, which has elevated their ceiling to a championship ceiling, I think. But what can you depend on from Tatum and Kemba, who are going to be the most natural scorers of the basketball, will kind of determine where they go.
And this was not an encouraging performance, because Tatum looked scared, and he did not look like he was ready for the moment, and Kemba was just missing shots. This is really an inexcusable loss for the Celtics, and we can commend the Heat, we can commend their effort, we can commend Jimmy Butler and Goran Dragic and everything that they did to take this game from the jaws of defeat, but this is an inexcusable loss for the Boston Celtics. They had this game in the palm of their hands, and they blew it. And I don't know how that changes the dynamics of this series, because I was confidently going Celtics. I didn't think that this was going to go seven. I didn't even think it was going to go six. Now I think that it probably will, but the Celtics are still on another level talent-wise. The question is, do they have the confidence? Do they inspire fear into their opponents? And tonight it looked like they were the ones with the fear in their eyes.
It'll be an interesting thing to track throughout this series. We're going to get to a break after this question, but I do want to ask about Tyler Hero, because this is somebody that has been inflated kind of as a joke, but also at this point kind of not, because of how he carries himself, the confidence he has. People internally in the Heat organization apparently believe he can be better than Devin Booker. That's lunacy. But the guy is completely, I say it again, unafraid. What other rookie have you seen just step into a stage like this, especially in a setting like the bubble, where everything's odd already, and just make big shot after big shot after big shot and not ever hesitate? He deserves to be on the floor in their closing lineups, and it really is truly very impressive.
Yeah. No, he's a marvel. There are very few players like him that I have seen in my life, and he was one of my favorite prospects in a draft that I didn't really like all that much, just because I thought he could be so easily weaponized off the ball, as we've seen the Heat do. I thought that he could create for himself well enough. Such a fluid, high-level shot maker, and he's always competed. He has a famous negative wingspan, which is obviously a disadvantage in the NBA, but he at times is able to make up for it just by playing so hard. Obviously not a plus defender, but he is in so many ways an embodiment of the Heat culture, especially when Jimmy Butler, who loves him, is at the center of it. It's that brash confidence and that defensive intensity and just the idea that you think you can win at all times. And Hero embodies that in a lot of ways, and it's ridiculous. I mean, the willingness with which he'll just step into a 25-footer in a late-game situation and just think, yeah, I'll probably make this. And so often he does. You don't see that from a rookie who wasn't a top-5 pick in the draft, who isn't some all-world talent. He was just kind of a guy, and he's phenomenal. I don't think the ceiling is really all that high. We saw some fascinating playmaking from him today that we've almost never seen with the 9 assists and the 11 rebounds.
Nearly a triple-double. Unreal.
Yeah, expecting winning all around in a way that you don't normally see from him. I don't see the Devin Booker ceiling, but at the very least, he's a really good player, and he's a winner. And this Heat team has a bunch of winners.
It's crazy, but in a lot of ways, in this postseason, Tyler Hero has contributed to bigger moments and had bigger moments than Devin Booker has had in his entire career, which is weird because Devin Booker scored 73 in a game. But it's true, I think, in these high-level situations, what can you do? Tyler Hero is going to be a real asset. And what he's proved in this postseason, I think, gets the Heat much more into doors with the Milwaukee Bucks and trade discussions if they want to go there. We're not going to dive into all that right now, though. We're going to step aside. We'll talk about the Clippers and the Nuggets, who are underway in their Game 7. After this, we're on the phone with Carson Brever of the Nerd Sesh Podcast. This is WKGN Fox Sports Knoxville Fan Run Radio. Run it up. We're in the dying embers now. The end game, if you will. Carson Brever's with us. Just saw a rousing basketball game complete between the Boston Celtics and the Miami Heat. They make way for the Nuggets and Clippers, who find themselves entangled in a Game 7 that we really should have never gotten to, but the Clippers have found a way to not win this series. The Nuggets have played a part in that, but we're going to take the next 15 minutes or so to really focus on those Los Angeles Clippers and ask some existential questions about what might happen, because this game will not be over by the time we get off the air. It'll probably be the content of this episode, this segment, will probably be pretty dated by tomorrow. Or it could not be. The Nuggets could win. So, Carson Brever, let's just subtract ourselves now from this Game 7 environment and do some hypotheticals. Fill in the blank for me. If the Clippers lose, Doc Rivers is what?
Oh, man. I would say on the hot seat. I don't think he gets fired just because not only is he so accomplished, I think that the players like him, but honestly, that decision probably comes down to Kawhi Leonard, because the Clippers are going to be in desperation mode trying to hold on to this core now, because obviously they believe that it is championship caliber, and if Doc isn't the guy that Kawhi wants in there, yeah, of course it is. But if Doc isn't the guy that Kawhi wants, then, you know, get rid of him. I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily the right basketball decision, but there are important things to manage with the dynamics of this team if things go south here, because that is the kind of crushing loss and disappointment that a team of this caliber hasn't experienced in basketball in a long while.
Again, it would just kind of speak to this curse floating in the ether of you're now 0-8 in games that could send you to the conference finals. Is this the only organization in the NBA that, I guess the Hornets probably have never gotten to that conference championship level, but You have to internally, it's gut check time, and you're right. Their timetable is the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. Or actually, really, the next 1 year. These two players, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, they're signed on for 2 years each, and they're free agents after this next season. So whatever you do, you've got to do it now. If you think Doc Rivers is a problem, you got to make a change. But Montrezl Harrell spoke about this months ago, and a lot of people wrote him off, but he said this team doesn't feel like a team yet. Yep. And that's what it feels like right now. Do you think we could see some roster changes if they lose this game?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't know who would go, because when I look at the construction of this team, I think that it is pretty much engineered for playoff success, unless your flaw is Paul George being your second guy who doesn't step up in the big moment. I honestly wonder if one of the guys who they might consider moving would be Lou Williams, because that's a guy who has a huge amount of intrigue in a lot of places just because of how dynamic he is offensively. And it's tough to imagine splitting up the Trez-Lou pick-and-roll tandem just because that has been so unbelievable over these past couple seasons. But at the same time, we've seen it. Lou, both of their values diminish in the playoffs, and especially Lou just because he's such a liability defensively. And when you have Kawhi and Paul George out there, you don't really need that third 20-point-per-game scorer, primary ball handler, and playmaker. So I think that that could be interesting and see if they try to pick up a little bit more 3-and-D versatile wing. But then again, they have those guys on this roster. I guess JaMychal Green isn't the best version of it. Marcus Morris isn't the best version of it. But they have as much versatility as far as positionally as any team in basketball. And if it's not enough, then I think if that's a cultural thing more than anything on the basketball court.
Which you can't just trade for and you can't just sign. It is very hard to build. And we're seeing organizations with strong cultures, i.e. the Miami Heat, have that mean a little bit more in this bubble scenario even than it might in a normal season. The Clippers are the most talented team in basketball. I don't think anybody is denying that. We talked about how we both believe that if you took the two best players off the Lakers and the Clippers, the Lakers supporting cast would get swept by the Los Angeles Clippers supporting cast.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if this goes south, and by the way, I want to get your read on this. Do you think the Nuggets will win this game?
No, but my confidence in the Clippers diminishes just about every second because the Nuggets are locked into this game, and again, all it takes is one explosion from Jokic and Murray, and the Clippers are on their heels. So I don't think that they're going to lose. Previously, though, I would have said I can't imagine them losing, and now that I'm seeing it, I can imagine them losing.
Landry Shamet just got hurt, which is a massive blow if he's unable to really return into this game. It means we're going to see a lot of Lou Williams, which leaves a big hole for Jamal Murray to attack. I can't talk today. For Jamal Murray to attack on the defensive end of the floor. I just don't know where the moves come, right? It's not like they have assets to trade. They use their last ace in the hole, if you will, to get Mook Morris at the deadline. And that guy's a free agent at the end of the year. So is Montrezl Harrell. So you either really lock into this core with guys who are flawed playoff players, or I don't know what you do. Maybe they try and do a sign-and-trade thing for Gordon Hayward, especially if Hayward opts in, but I don't know how they cobble together those salaries or incentivize the Celtics to do that. Well, I just don't know what their play is.
I think the answer is if they're going to mix things up, they trade good players for good players who they think are better fits. Because you're right, they don't have assets, they don't have draft picks, but they have Lou Williams, and there's a lot of teams in basketball that want Lou Williams.
I don't know why.
And well, just because he's a really good player, and it, you know, obviously he has tremendous value, maybe not necessarily as far as winning goes, but he's a dynamic player, and he's a guy who's really fun to watch, and he puts up numbers, and not to be extremely anti-Lou Williams, because I think that what he's done with his career, especially late, this revolution has been really impressive. But again, he's not the best playoff guy. But I think that that's what you do. You find the valuable players on this roster who you just don't think quite fit for what you're trying to build, and you swap them for players of a similar caliber who are more in your vision, more aligned with the culture you're trying to build, and the model you want to have on the basketball court.
What probability do you give it? And I'll just comment quickly, actually, before I get to that. On the Lou Williams thing, I think Lou Williams is infinitely more valuable to bad teams than good teams, and I'll just leave it there.
Yep, probably true.
What is the probability that they move Paul George?
Next to none. I mean, Kawhi was going to refuse to go to LA unless Paul George wasn't involved in that, so I really don't see that happening. I think that even though he's flawed, they see him as an essential part of this star tandem, and I don't think that that would fly with Kawhi, and Kawhi is priority number one, two, three, et cetera, for this team.
I just, when I think of locker room culture, and I'm not saying Paul George is a bad culture guy, but just one of the things that I think could be driving a wedge, and this is purely speculative, I just know if it were in my situation, I don't know how I could be professional here. Here's a backstory, if you don't know. I know, Carson, you do, but just for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Paul George was in a relationship with Doc Rivers' daughter. He cheated on her and had a child with another woman. That has to have some effect, I would think, on their relationship. And Doc Rivers has been a guy who's been able to connect with teams throughout his career. Always. That has been his best asset, is him as a manager of people, not necessarily as a basketball coach. He's able to get a lot of guys that didn't necessarily have personalities that you would say were winning personalities before they got to Boston. There's some revisionist history there. But when they put the big three together, he got those personalities to mesh, right? And he's done that throughout his career. Last year's Clippers team had one of the best cultures in the league.
Yep.
But here we are, and they've added these new pieces, and it's not come together. I just I don't know what you do.
Well, my counter to that being a Paul George issue is that, again, if Kawhi needs Paul George on this team, that becomes a Doc Rivers issue. And that's not necessarily fair, and maybe that's the wrong approach. But if Kawhi says that Paul George has to be on this team, Paul George will be on this team. Because he is clearly not afraid, as understated and quiet as he tends to be, he is not afraid to assert his opinion and his influence as far as how a team is structured. And especially when he came here with a specific vision in mind, you can't really then go and change that vision. But I do think you make a good point. I mean, there may be a fractured dynamic there because Doc Rivers is humor. He's a great leader, human. He's a great leader of men, but he's human. And you can't expect him to just pretend that that doesn't exist in his mind. Again, both of us are speaking with minimal knowledge of what it's like to be in a locker room with these guys. Absolutely zero knowledge, in fact. But we know how humans are. So it's an interesting point.
Yeah, and we hear the murmurs and the speculation about how their locker room isn't necessarily all the way plugged in. And I have to wonder. You think of things like that, and it's like, how could that not be playing in a role when you hear these stories? The first quarter has ended. It's 24-24, so the Nuggets hanging on in this basketball game. Let's move on from the Clippers, although I do find them infinitely more intriguing. Let's talk about the Nuggets right now. We've made a lot about the Celtics and their young core getting to this plateau of the conference title and what it means for their organization and the opportunity to play in the finals. Let's talk about the Nuggets. The Lakers are already waiting for whoever wins this basketball game. If the Nuggets were to win, do you give them any fighting chance of beating the Lakers? I mean, Jamal Murray is going to be a tough cover.
Yeah, Jamal Murray is a tough cover. I would say, though, that LeBron and AD are a tougher cover.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that essentially what we saw the Lakers do to the Rockets as far as exposing the lack of a rim protector and just going downhill over and over and over again, especially LeBron, I think that they can essentially replicate that against the Nuggets because Jokic is taller, but he doesn't get higher. He can't jump. So I think that there's a weakness to be exposed in that defense as far as the lack of rim protection that when we look at a team like the Clippers, so many of their great shot makers are perimeter or mid-range guys, or it's Trez, who is very strong but can't vertically just go over somebody like a LeBron or an AD could. So I think it's a problematic matchup for the Nuggets. But then again, Jokic is obviously going to more than make up for that on the offensive end. I think that AD on Jokic would be an interesting matchup as far as how well AD actually plays him. Generally, really almost no big man can give Jokic all that much trouble defensively. Gobert had a few really good games in that series, but traditionally, Jokic has kind of just been able to move Gobert to whatever spot he wants to as well because he's just almost impossible to stop as a one-on-one scorer because you can guard him well and he'll just put the shot up over you anyways and it'll go in. I mean, look at all the one-footers he's shooting. They're almost high percentage looks at this point. Like, the guy is just unbelievable. He's a freak, and he's been the best player on the court in this first quarter. He has been the most reliable star in this series, save maybe Kawhi, although Kawhi had one down game and Jokic hasn't had one. So I think that it would be interesting to see if he can really put himself in that AD tier in that series. He's not going to be in the LeBron tier, but in that AD tier. Maybe I honestly just don't think that there's much of a fighting chance. But I wouldn't have told you that they would be in a game seven against the Clippers either, as much as I love this team. And I wouldn't have expected myself to be sitting here after a quarter saying it really looks like they could go out there and win this game.
Yeah, and I think you make a lot of good points there about Jokic. It's a thing in fighting that an awkward fighter is a dangerous fighter. It's a big thing in boxing. A lot of people say it about Tyson Fury, who is the heavyweight champion of the world, so he's doing something right. Nikola Jokic is kind of in that mold. As a defender in basketball, you base your reactive motions to what the offensive player is doing on muscle memory. You see these things that players do. They're conventional. You you get an idea for where a guy might go based on the body language they show you. And that's why Jokic is so tough, is because he does things so awkwardly, so slowly, and he just knows how to get to the right places to where he can get a shot off, and it goes in because of his touch. I don't know if the Lakers defensively can really throw anything at him to stop him. I don't know if there's a guy in the league that can.
Yeah, the only thing you can throw at him is a really intelligent defender with insanely long arms like Rudy Gobert, and even then, Jokic was able to get his for the most part. He is, in an interesting way, one of the more unstoppable scorers in basketball, and I would say, honestly, I will come out here and say right now, probably the most underrated scorer in basketball, just because it's so easy for him to go and get 25 a game in the playoffs, just because he doesn't do it in the regular season, basically because he doesn't want to, because that's not his preference for how he likes to play the game of basketball, and because he also kind of enjoys to coast in the regular season, doesn't mean he's not capable of it. He is maybe the best post-scorer in basketball, just as far as pragmatism. You think about a guy like Embiid, who has the more traditional bag of post moves, but no one can stop 280-pound Jokic getting to his spots and shooting a hook over you or shooting that one-footed turnaround. So I think that is a part of the game that he excels in so much and is truly at the top of basketball that he doesn't get enough credit for. And, you know, it's interesting because it's not the number one strength of his game as passing is, but I think that's just a testament to how great he is. And to me, he is no question a top eight player in basketball and certainly is the kind of guy that you want trying to guide your team to the conference finals and the playoffs.
So let's talk a little bit now about his counterpart, Jamal Murray. The Lakers don't have a ready-made stop for a guard like him, but they haven't had a ready-made stop for James Harden or Damian Lillard either, and they've found ways to defend them. How do you anticipate they come out and try and bother Jamal Murray and make sure that he doesn't have the 50-point games, that he's closer to the 15-point games that we've seen at times throughout this postseason?
What I will say about Jamal is he kind of stops himself or he doesn't get stopped. You can throw really high-level perimeter defenders on him, especially people who get physical with him can give him trouble, but he's not the kind of dynamic athlete who's blowing by inferior defenders. That's not what he does. He just happens to be one of the best contested shot makers in the sport, and it's kind of like Jokic in that way, that it's really unique. You don't see it a lot, and it's really tough to stop. It's a difficult thing to do day in and day out, and that's why he has so many inconsistent performances. But, I mean, you just put your best perimeter defenders on him, and obviously the entire focus of their defense is going to be the Murray-Jokic pick and roll. You can't double Murray out of it because then you're leaving Jokic, or, you know, obviously you rotate there and then there's a shooter open. Nikola Jokic is a very good bet to find him.
Right.
So you just put your best perimeter defender on him and you hope that he doesn't have one of those series where he's just lights out, because if he does, there's really not all that much you can do to stop it. He's making shots with hands in his faces because that's just what, that's his natural born ability. That's what he does at a really high level.
Even still, best case scenario, Jokic is killing it. Murray is cooking. You trust the Lakers to outscore the Nuggets in almost any situation, right?
Yeah, just because the Nuggets can't do that for seven games. They can do it for three or four. They can't do it for seven, and if they don't do it for seven, the Lakers are, even with the level of effort we've seen from the Nuggets lately, the Lakers are on another level defensively, and they have, we've talked about unstoppable players when they're going. It's a lot easier for LeBron and AD to be unstoppable, especially than it is for Jamal Murray to be unstoppable. And I bet on that basically every game, especially considering there's no one who can really make them work that hard defensively on this Nuggets roster. I think it's kind of going to be a breath of fresh air, especially for AD, who just had to go up against PJ Tucker, who he couldn't move. Mm-hmm. And I think that those two are going to thrive.
Okay, last couple questions here. Do you anticipate, in a couple words, the Lakers to stay with the small ball lineup that they discovered against the Rockets, trying to match them with Anthony Davis finally playing center, which I think is their best lineup? Do you think they continue to do that against Jokic and company?
I do, and I think that it's interesting that we saw them play so many fives alongside AD throughout the regular season, where that was obviously their starting lineup almost every time out there, and AD said that's what he wanted, but I think that we're seeing in the biggest spots that's not what's best for them. The Nuggets basically play four wings and Jokic. Sometimes they obviously are playing Paul Millsap, who's a more traditional four, but he's also 6'7". So you put LeBron on him, who's strong and has the frame where he can hang with him, and that's not really going to be a problem. So I think that is what they have to do, because otherwise, I think that the Nuggets are just going to find more open looks, and it's going to be easier to expose a slower Lakers defense.
All right, last question here. Carson Brebber, you are as steeped in the history of this league as pretty much anybody I know. Super studied and well-read over the annals of time of the NBA. If the Nuggets do this, they will have overcame 3-1 deficits in back-to-back series. Where does this accomplishment stand up in juxtaposition to the history of the league?
I might argue that it is the most impressive feat that has ever been accomplished outside of winning a championship.
Whoa.
And you look back to, obviously, AI carrying that Sixers team to the finals. People love to point to that one. And yes, that was incredible. Also look at the quality of the Eastern Conference back then. The reason I say that is because 3-1 comebacks have only happened, I want to say, 7 times coming into this postseason. To do it twice in a row against the Clippers, who are so much more talented than the Nuggets. Like, it's a different level. With a 23-year-old Jamal Murray having to go out there and consistently create for you at a high level with a Serbian fellow who really doesn't move like an NBA player out there as your star, that to me is one of the all-time narratives and all-time accomplishments in this sport. And I think it really ranks up there in an all-time sense, and it probably won't be remembered that way, especially if they don't even get out of the conference finals, but I think it has to be up there.
All right, Carson, thank you for our time. We'll stop holding you over. You can go watch the game in peace now. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks, Payton.
All right, that was Carson Brebber, of course, of the Nerd Sesh podcast, always on the show because he makes the show a little bit better every time he's on.
He does.
Justin, how did we do today?
I thought it was good. Hey, Payton, you want to tell the people how our pick'em went Friday for NFL games?
It sounds like you do. So I know I went 6-9. Not very nice.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay.
That's tight.
Cool.
I went 10-5.
That's pretty good.
That's 66%. Last time I checked. I haven't done math in a while. But they say in Vegas, if you're hitting 55%, that's excellent. 50% is average. 66%.
It's above average.
Putting up Hall of Fame numbers over here in 1 week.
We'll see what happens.
But
in
as
week
Henry
two.
Said, it's not overreact to week one.
You play to win the game.
You play to win the game.
And that is what we will leave you on. This has been Run It Up. We'll run it back tomorrow. We got a little bit better today. Thank you, everybody out there, for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow. Okay. I'm a man. I'm 40. That's how we'll send you out.